For zipsportsmedia.com, this is Touchline. Hello everybody and welcome to episode 7 of this famous football podcast, Touchline. I'm your host, Sean Watson, my co-pilot, my co-host alongside me, Aaron Flanagan of Mirror Sport. Aaron, how are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. Yourself?
Very well indeed, yeah.
I like the way you describe us as famous now, like, about 7 episodes in and yet suddenly we're into stardom.
I was going to say award winning, but the only award we've won is from that I've been given myself. So.
I'll make one, we'll put it on the mantelpiece.
All right.
No, nobody will question it.
Well, if you wrap it up, you can give it me for Christmas.
Oh, okay, that's done.
There you go.
It's not much of a surprise, though, now, is it?
Well, all right, make it a bit more shocking for me.
Dress it up,
put some baubles on it.
All right, okay, yeah, we'll go with that.
Trophy cabinet. Yeah, so episode 7 is upon us already. We've sort of flown through these first 6. Episode 7 is here. We want to start off by wishing everybody a Merry Christmas. It's getting up to that time of year now. I think we're on the 15th of December today. The light's virtually gone. It's only 4 o'clock and it's virtually dark here where we're doing the podcast, so yeah, all the best to everybody listening to this podcast. Have a good Christmas and New Year. I'm sure we'll speak to you before New Year. We'll try and squeeze one in between Christmas and New Year. We'll start off this week sort of where it's a nice segue from episode 6, because episode 6 we were recording the podcast, if you remember, down at Curzon Ashton. Aaron's schedule sort of dictated the podcast location that week. It was the Thursday before the Sunday of the Curzon Ashton Wimbledon game in the FA Cup. Unless you've been hiding under a rock or been on the moon or hibernating, you will know sort of the outcome of that game. Aaron's the best possible person we could have got to talk about this game. I saw his piece that he wrote for, was it Non-League News?
Non-League Daily.
Non-League Daily.
Yeah.
Summed the day up perfectly, but we're going to ask him to sum it up again for this podcast. Aaron, try and display, and try and give us your side of the story.
It was, without a doubt, the most painful day I've ever had in football. That's as a fan, as a referee, as a player. I mean, I didn't play for very long as a youngster, but you know, from all the different involvements I've had in football, I've never experienced such pain and disappointment as that. And I say disappointment, it wasn't really disappointment. I was so proud of Curzon Ashton.
Yeah.
To go 3-0 up against a team challenging for the playoffs 3 leagues above you, it's just phenomenal. But to still be 3-0 up with kind of 10 minutes left and you lose the game is just... I mean, it's like having... it's hard to... It's like having the world in your hands and it literally just turns to jelly and slips out. And it's just... I've never cried at a football match before until that day. I actually cried when our second goal went in rather than, just because of the disbelief and I didn't know what to do with myself. And then there was tears as well when it all disappeared at the... At the death, it was just the most shocking thing. I mean, when you're around everybody on the day as well, you feel all right. You're proud, you know. Everyone, you've got that sense of accomplishment. But when it got to the next day, the Monday, the day of the third round draw, the day waking up that morning was awful. It all hit home. How close you were, how you're not in the draw, and you know that later that day you're going to find out whether you're going to be playing Manchester United, Liverpool, yeah. Chelsea. And
the only saving grace was that they drew Sutton away.
Oh, I was over it after the draw.
Well, yeah.
I mean, admittedly, it took me pretty much an hour after the draw was drawn to even bear looking at my phone to see who we would have drawn. I couldn't do it. I was that scared and that petrified.
Well, I was saying to people,
to know what we've missed out on.
Yeah, I was saying, as soon as Wimbledon got the fourth, I said it's probably nailed on now that they'll get United at Old Trafford or City or whoever.
Yeah.
Sod's Law, I think it's called Murphy's Law. The Law of Murphy, as Louis van Gaal once quoted. I'll give you my perspective if you're interested. As a semi-neutral, obviously I was supporting Curzon on the day because why would I not? And virtually everybody was, unless you're a Wimbledon fan.
Yeah. You watched it on the TV, didn't you? You weren't...
I did. Yeah. I watched it. So it was slightly different perspective.
Yeah, well, you say the games always look different when from being live and as involved as I am on the day to obviously watching as a spectator on TV.
Yeah.
Would have been a weird experience watching Curzon on TV, I imagine.
Do you know what? It really was, because 5-6 years ago, I actually followed Curzon quite a lot because of the likes of Aaron and a couple of friends of mine followed Curzon. So I used to go to quite a few games myself. So I've got quite a vested interest in the club as well. And turning on BT Sport at 11:30 to the shot from the blimp and just showing all of Ashton on the and the ground and Ike in the background, I was like, wow, you know, it's quite an experience. It was the build up, people getting, you know, the likes of your dad, John Fanningham, being interviewed, and I saw a couple of friends on the telly, and it was a fantastic experience. And as soon as the whistle went for the kickoff, and I'm thinking, and I don't know if you remember, but Wimbledon went right up from the kickoff and had the sort of a half chance where the ball went through to the keeper and Hakan Burton sort of grabbed it. And I'm thinking, oh God, don't go down right away. Don't go 1-0 down right away. And well, they didn't go one down right away. They went right up the other end. And Chris Perry, the commentator, said, it's a good chance for the Curzon national players on television to show what they can do. And no sooner had he said that, Adam Auger picks up the ball, ping, top corner. Oh my goodness. I was off my seat. Oh my God, they won't get in quick. Look at this. Honestly, one of the moments of the season for me, seeing that goal just whistle into the top bag.
Honestly, I mean, since I've now been over the result, you know, and it's not as painful, you can reflect, you can smile at what we've done. The amount of times I've watched that first goal, and also the third goal where, you know, he gets his hat-trick and you see the crowd jumping around behind the net and seeing so many people passionate about Curzon. I mean, that's what the FA Cup's about. Yeah. I mean, it really, really was. And just memories we can cherish forever.
Yeah.
Also heartbreak to cry about for the rest of our lives. But
do you know what? Memories. The heartbreak will fade. You'll get over it. You'll look back and think, well, we were part of a great game there. One of the best in FA Cup history. Certainly the best game in the FA Cup so far this season.
Yeah.
From my perspective, even when they went 3-0 up, I was texting a friend of mine who was like, so who are Curzon getting in the fourth round? And I was like, hold on, there's still at least half an hour to go here, hold on. And they were getting 78 minutes, and at no point did I think it's over this game, because you just had the feeling if they got one, they'd get all three or even four.
Yeah, well, one of the most frustrating things for me was at the point where they got their first goal and made probably about 3-1, I'm stood at the end of the tunnel in between the two dugouts with the head steward, planning how do we combat the pitch invasion. Like, we were to that point of planning.
From Curzon,
yeah. We were at that point of planning. 3-0 up, 10 minutes to go, right, let's plan. How do we deal with this pitch invasion? How do we make sure we get the plays off? We're in the full-on processing stage. We're in the mindset. You are at 3-0 up with 10 minutes left, that you've won this match, and to have it all just taken away is cool.
But, what would you put it down to? I mean, for me personally, once the first one went in, it was a bit of panic. The players sort of thought, oh, blimey.
I don't think the first one was panic.
After the first one?
I think after the first goal went out, I thought we were relatively comfortable, but they put on some big strikers. Yeah. They started playing, in a way, where they played the non-league way. They started doing the hoofball forward while we were still trying to pass it.
Yeah.
And we got caught overplaying it a little bit.
That's true. I think your left back gave it away cheaply. And
yeah, I mean, I'm not going to criticise.
No, we're not naming him.
Because he was phenomenal. He was one of the best players on the pitch.
Every play to a man was absolutely superb. You can't put fault at anybody's feet.
It's one of the technical ability of them lot and the physical strength. Just showed at the end, because I mean, at the end of the day, our goalkeeper's kept us in it for a lot of the game as well.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, he probably won't look back at the game in too much fondness, is a shame, because of how he played for 80 minutes.
Yeah.
Really didn't deserve the end of the game. But
not at all. I mean, because some of the saves he made, the one in the second half, the dipping volley that he managed to tip over the bar. If you'd seen that in the Premier League, you'd have thought, bloody hell, what a save.
Yeah. No, he's a. Everyone on the pitch, everyone at the club just did an absolutely phenomenal job. And pleased to say that we could play such a pivotal role in an FA Cup Classic, and just hope the next time we get there, we get over the line.
Yeah, and there'll be a next time. The only thing was, for me, it made it more heartbreaking, the fact that they got to 3-3, and then there was a period of 15 minutes where it looked like, well, at least we're in the hat. We're going to get a replay here.
Yeah.
And it was the last kick of the game.
I mean, slightly selfishly, you know, I wouldn't have been able to attend the replay.
Right.
So
you said that to me on the last podcast.
Yeah,
I think.
So when it was 3-3 and there's like a couple of minutes left, I'm thinking, oh, this is this is not convenient at all.
The logistics of this are just so poor. Nothing like the emotion of football, Aaron.
No, I was thinking about, God, what excuses do I have to make to, you know, to change my plans and stuff. That's what was running through my head. And then, obviously didn't need to use any of what I came up with.
It was sort of an apologetic win from Wimbledon.
I've got to say, credit to Wimbledon as well. Not only did obviously they come back and produce a stunning comeback on the day, they were superb. They were gracious. They were friendly. The way they conducted themselves, everything from the supporters to the players to the fans.
Yeah. I don't know if you managed to catch Neil Ardley, the manager.
Yes.
That is his post-match interview. He was sort of like, we didn't really deserve to come out of that game winners. It was sort of an apologetic victory speech.
He's been in touch with my dad since, and the contact has been made and has stayed strong since the match between the two clubs. So if you're listening, Neil, pre-season friendly would be very, very nice. Thank you.
Home or away?
Away. I want a day out. I want a trip out, me.
Down to Wimbledon. Yeah, why not? Why not? Yeah. And like I say, the heartbreak will fade over time, and you'll look back and think, wow, we're part of a bloody good game.
Yeah.
And no, it was. And it was. Moving on. We'll move on from that. Aaron can dry his tears and we'll move on to the Premier League. I wanted to touch on something we've seen a bit of a turnaround. On this podcast, when we've said something, the exact opposite's happened. The very first episode, we said, it looks like United and City are going to be the two vying it out for the league. Yeah. Within the next episode, 2 weeks' time, United have lost four on the trot, or something, three on the trot, something like that, and they were out of the race. A couple of weeks ago, we said, City are looking strong, and I said, I'm worried they're going to win the league. Since then, they won last night against Watford, but since then, they've not been through a great run of form. Last night was only the second clean sheet in something like 17 games, 18 games.
I don't know, I think it's only the second... what was the stats? Or something about home wins. Oh, it's only the second home clean sheet in 14 games, I think is what they...
Right.
Or what it was, or something like that. But just... I can't really put my finger on what... Well, I mean, I can have a few suggestions of what's gone wrong for City. But, you know, it shouldn't have gone this badly wrong, you know, with the calibre of the squad, the intelligence of the manager. It just seems to... have not clicked yet, and it's quite bizarre seeing that happen. I don't really know what to say about it. I just think defensively they seem to buy a new centre back every season, yet they're still playing John Stones alongside two full backs as three central defenders. And John Stones is not a good enough defender. He's a good footballer, but you're putting him alongside players who are not great defenders. So it's going to be an absolute catastrophe.
Does City lack a leader? Oh, I think that's a bit of a redundant question. Without Vincent Kompany, I think it's pretty obvious they do lack a leader at the back.
Maybe they do, but I think they have got the personnel. I just think that they're playing the wrong people. I know Pep Guardiola is going to want footballers, people who can play football and play to this kind of style of play he built up at Barcelona and Bayern Munich, maybe in a slightly adapted system, but... You need defenders at the back. He's playing defenders who cannot defend. And City are leaking goals. And, you know, until he changes it up so that, you know, people who are willing to put in a tackle, you know, does. I mean, I don't know what his plans are for January, but at the moment I'd be inclined to put people like Fernandinho and, you know, alongside Otamendi, you know, players who are willing to, you know, get the foot in, they're physically strong. Because at the moment, Gael Clichy, Alexander Kolarov, Bakary Sagna, I mean, they're not centre backs, and they're playing centre back.
No, and with that system, you need a bit of pace in your team as well.
Yeah,
well, I mean, Kolarov just doesn't bring that at all.
I compare City's three at the back to Chelsea's three at the back. Chelsea have David Luiz in there, again, a man who cannot defend.
No,
but they put him alongside two defenders.
Right,
two people who, you know, they can compensate for it, and City can do exactly the same and get the best out of John Stones if they do that. You can play John Stones in there, and having a ball player in there really will work, but you've got to put him alongside defenders, and at the moment they're not. They're playing him putting him next to players who are playing out of position. And as I say, City are really, really suffering, and it's something for me that Guardiola has to sort out pretty quickly.
Yeah. Obviously, take Watford out of it. The past two league games have ended 3-1 against Chelsea on the wrong end of that, and 4-2. I know I said 4-0. Should have been 4-0. 4-2 against Leicester. But in that, in the Chelsea game, the end of it, as soon as I saw this, I thought, oh, that's podcast talk. The tackle from Aguero on David Luiz. In terms of bad tackles, where would you rank it? I don't know where I'd rank it.
It's one of the worst in Premier League history.
Yeah, yeah. Did you do a piece on this?
I had to do an article.
Yeah, I
about 24 hours after it, he said, do us a favour, can you rank all the worst tackles in Premier League history? I thought, fine, no, it's right up my street. You know, previously referee, I know what I'm, well, I should know what I'm looking out for as far as what determines a bad tackle. And there were tackles that got into my top 10 that weren't as bad as Aguero's. I mean, if you were to do a new list, you know, I think Aguero gets in the top 5. I think Roy Keane, obviously, is...
I don't think anybody else has passed Roy Keane. That's a nailed on.
I mean, that was the worst of all time. And there's the obviously notorious one from Kevin Nolan when he was at Newcastle on Victor Anichebe.
Ben Thatcher.
Ben Thatcher.
Is that even a tackle?
Well, I mean, that's what I'll put in the piece. It's not even a tackle. It's an assault. It's thuggery. Yeah. It's...
There have been some badders, but when I saw that first time, most of the time with a bad tackle, you need a replay. Yeah. I do watching the telly, but you just see his body angle, and I thought, that is a disgusting tackle. That is awful.
Yeah. And of course, he's got history with Luis as well.
Yeah, he has.
Doing something again, so I don't know what has happened in the past between the two of them. I know it's obviously Brazil, Argentina. There might be something to do with that, but... They clearly don't like each other.
Well, David Luiz has given his fair share as well over the years. Let's not forget that.
Yeah, no, he's
had that one coming, I think.
Yeah, yeah, but, absolutely.
But unsavoury scenes at the end. So, is Guardiola under a little bit of pressure as of right now? I mean, I don't think there's any danger of him actually leaving or being sacked. But
no, but I think City fans are expecting more. I think... At the moment, City fans wanted to see development from Manuel Pellegrini in his season. At the moment, they're not. They're still seeing defenders who can't defend, football that's inconsistent, football, in truth, that's a little bit slow. It's not particularly exciting a lot of the time. It's not quite what City fans expected it would be. Obviously, it might still take a little bit of time, but at the moment, it's not working. It's not great to watch. It's hard to... motivate yourself to say yes, City are going to be great today, and you're not. You just think they're just going to slug through, going to have a few hairy moments, and they might win, rather than they're going to be playing the great attractive football and entertain you like the Pep Guardiola Barcelona team did.
Yeah, these things do take time though, and you've seen by contrast, you are now starting to see a bit of an upturn in Man United with Mourinho at the helm. All right, they're still flailing badly in the league, but the signs are there that he's actually getting his system right, his personnel right. Seems to have settled on a back four. He's kept his back four sort of pretty... I think Rojo and Jones have partnered each other for the past three or four games. Well, they look pretty good.
I was going to say, if anyone would have said 2 months ago, United's change of fortunes will be down to Phil Jones and Marcus Rojo, people would have all laughed at it, but they've been...
Exactly.
Nothing short of sensational. They've been absolutely brilliant, the pair of them.
And that, for me, that is all a team needs. You need to pick the same players in the same positions for a period of time and let them gel, let them get to know the positions, and let them get a bit of confidence from being in the team.
Yeah.
There's no use chopping and changing your 11 every game. Because
talking of chopping, I mean, Marcus Rojo obviously wanted Christmas off with some of his tackle attempts recently.
I was just going to bring that up, yeah.
But I mean, when you're playing so well and you've got your place in the team, I don't get why you're doing anything as stupid as that and diving. Not once. Because he must have had a telling off after the first one when he got away with it.
The first one was disgusting.
As much as Mourinho says, he's a good fair player in his interviews, you can bet your life that he dragged him in training.
Yeah.
And he said, you've got to sort that out. You're a liability.
Well, that could have cost United the game last night. It was 1-1. Yeah. I think it was 1-1. Maybe 1-0. But a pivotal moment in the game, half an hour to go. And he decided to lunge in, but it seems to be just his style of tackling. That seems to be just like, oh well, there's the ball going with both feet.
I mean, it's not even a conventional way of tackling, because if you're diving in 2-footed, you're gonna have an uncomfortable landing regardless. Anyway, so it's not like,
yeah.
I mean, if you're gonna put in a half-arsed tackle, which is, and that's what I'm gonna say, it's a half-arsed tackle, because if you're diving in 2-foot, you're not gonna control the ball and win the ball. You're just gonna hit the ball and it's going to spin off.
Yeah.
But if you're going to put in a half-arse tackle, you're at least you know, don't try and hurt yourself in the process as well. Because, I mean, he is risking hurting himself as well as seriously, you know, hurting an opponent.
Yeah.
Which is, but anyway, back to the original point. United are looking very solid. They had a few scary moments as such, you know, against Everton a couple of weeks back, but last two Premier League games and Europa League game at Zoya, they've conducted themselves professionally, done a job, got over the line, and looking a little bit like the United of old.
Yeah, well, I think the game last night against Palace was... I was saying to a mate of mine who I watched the game with, and I said, I just felt there was a winner in it for United, and I said, well, that winner now could be something that actually turns United's season around and get it going. There's still time to turn the season around. They're still in every cup competition. Are they out of the league, 13 behind? We've seen Arsenal come from 12 behind.
Yeah.
I'd say they're out of the league.
I think they're out of the league. They're definitely in the top four running. The way it's going, Spurs, City, even Arsenal and Liverpool both all have the potential for dropping out, I think. As good as they all look when they're playing well,
yeah,
they all look dodgy at different points as well.
I'd agree.
I'd say maybe Arsenal the exception. Even I know Arsenal lost to Everton during the week. I think they looked pretty solid through that game. They created chances and they didn't quite finish them. And I think Arsenal actually are, for me, the surprise package of the season. I think they're a very, very good team, and I think they're well in title contention.
Have they got enough depth in their squad?
Yeah, I think they do. I think every time they've had to rotate it, because obviously they rotate the centre midfielders quite regularly. They've had, you know, Coquelin, Elneny come in for the likes of when, you know, like Ramsey and Xhaka haven't been playing.
Cazorla's there as well.
Yeah, and obviously Sanchez is now playing as this striker. When he's not there, you've got Giroud, and every time Giroud's come in, he's scored goals. For me, they've got enough. They've got a big enough squad. Defensively, they seem quite big on numbers. They seem to have two decent players in every possible position. I genuinely think that they could get over the line. I don't know where Chelsea are going to slip up. It doesn't look like they are going to slip up. But
again, if you'd have said that after five games, you'd have gone... Chelsea are going to win 10 in a row. They looked awful at the start of the season.
Yeah, no, they obviously adapted to the system, and it's worked brilliantly. I do genuinely think Arsenal will be the ones to pounce if Chelsea slip up, but I can't see it happening for Chelsea.
It's funny you mentioned Arsenal. It's almost like you knew the running order of this podcast this week. Cause,
I know, it's almost as if I get it texted me 24 hours in advance.
It's funny that, isn't it?
I wasn't actually thinking of the running order when... when I still went on to Arsenal then.
That's just your broadcasting nous. Just a bit of a lovely segue into for my money, what was the probably the best game of the season so far, Everton and Arsenal. Definitely the best last 10 minutes of the season so far.
Yeah, no, it was thrilling. It was end to end. There was a last minute goal. The atmosphere was loud. Football was good. Goal line clearances and
better check in the net with Stecklenburg at the same time.
Do you have any idea what he was doing?
Well, yeah, actually, I've watched the replay back, and he goes to challenge the keeper. The ball's floated in, he goes for the header. Stecklenburg gets his hand on the ball, but Cech sort of absolutely follows through, ends up tangled up in the back of the net. Everybody by this point has moved out of the box. Everton have pushed up to try and stop the second ball coming in. Arsenal strikers have followed them out, and Petr Cech's still trying to untangle his boots in the net. So he's now just about got up, and that's when somebody's taken the screenshot of him being in the net with Stecklenburg.
Right, okay.
It's just the classic keeper goes up, doesn't have a clue what to do with himself. Just looks like a bit of a ragdoll, just can't, you know, no coordination at all. But it made for an absolute frantic finish to the game. I was off my seat. I couldn't care less who won the game. But I was absolutely off my seat, shouting at the telly. Everton broke up the other end with no checking net, didn't score. Arsenal went right back up the other end, didn't score. It was mad.
It was quality. I mean, for me, there was one. It was the Iwobi shot, which got cleared off line by, I think it was
Leighton
Baines.
Yeah.
But that was the fourth shot in about the 5 seconds leading up to it, all of which were so close from getting in. A body went in the way, a tackle or something. It was just so exciting. And it's good to see Goodison Park loud and passionate again, because
I think it's one of the best home grounds in the league. Goodison Park.
It might well just be the best home ground in the league. I know there's talk of them potentially moving away in the future, but for me, if someone's going to build a new ground, like, you know, obviously a lot of clubs have got new grounds in the league. Tottenham are getting a new one. Chelsea are getting a new one. These big dome and oval grounds are, you know, all right, they're nice and pretty, but you never create an atmosphere in them. You need places like Goodison where every stand looks a bit different, everything's a different shape, everyone gets a different view. And then, you know, it's got a real identity to it. And, you know, it's a proper footballing venue. And it's a shame there's not more grounds like that still in the league.
I agree. And for me, it was the fans that actually carried Everton over the line there. They were the cliched 12th man.
That's one of football's favourite cliches.
Yeah, it is another one. That match was a perfect advert for the Premier League. That's another cliche.
Well, I tell you what, you say a perfect advert, it was, because it might make people watch it again. The Premier League, half the time this season, has been absolutely dire.
Yeah.
It really, really has. It is so refreshing to see a game played at such intensity, such pace, with such passion, because a lot of the time, I think the games are played out. And I don't know what it's to do with the tactics these days, you know, being a little slower, maybe going a little continental. It just doesn't quite flow at the same pace that maybe it used to. And maybe it's losing a little bit of its edge.
Okay. I know what you're saying. I've lost my train of thought. I was going to make a counterpoint to what I was saying about the Premier League. Yeah, I was just going to bring up the myth of the Premier League being the best league in the world. It's not the best league in the world. It's not even close in terms of quality. It's the competitiveness and the passion and I don't really know how to describe it, but just the teams are very similar standard. Anybody can beat anybody. Like, you wouldn't expect a lower league team in Spain go to Barcelona and beat them, but you'd expect Bournemouth to go to Arsenal and get something. Not expect, but it wouldn't be off the cards.
This for me is why we've got to be really, really careful with, obviously, the development of the Premier League into this international league. There's, you know, loads of obviously, you have the likes of foreign managers coming in, foreign players. You know, tactics are changing to maybe slightly adapt ourselves towards the European game. We've got to make sure that we don't lose the edge, and we are slowly becoming the World's League rather than England's League.
Yeah.
We are the World's League. So we just need to make sure that we keep the English identity in the game. And as I said, we are losing smidges of it.
Yeah, I agree.
It's going to be very, very important to keep the same intensity and the same passion.
Is part of the identity, sorry to cut you off, but part of the identity of the English League, is part of that the Christmas schedule? I know this is something you wanted to touch on, so here's your chance.
Yeah, I mean, for me personally, I love Christmas, and I'll be so disappointed if, you know, the Christmas schedule ever gets changed. One of the things I most look forward to about Christmas is the football.
Yeah.
And that's at all levels. That's obviously, I'm born and bred in non-league as well, so I love going out watching games pretty much every day of the week between, you know, Christmas and New Year.
It's a tradition. It is a tradition.
And all your big derby games and stuff happen, but then all the Premier League on, you know, TV, you know, all these different times, and it's brilliant. And then you've suddenly obviously got all these foreign managers coming in. Oh, I don't like, so everyone's tired, everyone's, it's like you're in English football or in English football. You know you're going to have a busy time, and you know it's going to be tough, but you get on with it in the English game, and you deal with it. For me personally, I don't think we need a winter break. And this is my own personal preference, because I don't care enough about the England national team. Because the way the FA say that, well, why they say we're considering a winter break, is for the benefit of the England football team, you know,
for
being
fitness,
fresher.
And, yeah.
For the summer, you know, having that rest, having all that. For me, I don't want to see that. I don't want to have 2-3 weeks without football, because just so the England team, you know, can, you know, do slightly better. You know, I want the football to keep on flowing. I'd much prefer watching the Premier League than I do to watching England. So I prefer to keep the Premier League football and keep the football free flowing, you know, throughout, rather than, you know, you know, hoping that it's the solution to England's problems, when I think England's problems do lie a lot deeper than the fact that they play 5 games in 3 weeks, which, in truth, isn't that ridiculous.
No, it's not. No. It's not even 2 games a week. That. I think you'd struggle to find somebody that disagrees with you there. If they were given a winter break, the players, and they turn up at a major tournament and got beat, which they inevitably would, it'd just be one less thing they'd have to use as an excuse.
Yeah.
Because they'd have a winter break. And like Aaron says, for me, I don't think tiredness or fatigue is any part of the reason why Iceland beat England in the Euros.
No. It definitely wasn't tiredness. England were almost definitely fitter and better equipped than Iceland were in that game. It's just the game meant so much more to Iceland.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a motivation and morale problem. It's nothing to do with fitness.
No.
They just wanted it more, so battled hard and held on to the victory.
Yeah, exactly. If you have a different opinion and you've got a good reason why there should be a winter break, please let us know. We'd be interested to hear it. Because there is a flip side, of course, there's a flip side to it. And if you want to play devil's advocate, drop us a comment, get in touch. You know, there is always two sides to the argument, but we personally think that a winter break would ruin the Christmas period. I think it'd bring a bit more misery.
I mean, I think they have said that if we're going to have a winter break, it'd be more like the start of January and stuff. But then as soon as you start putting that in there, you then start playing havoc with the FA Cup, you know, the last stages of the League Cup, you know, and you're clumping up the rest of the season. Like, you're actually going to make players play more in the back end of the season.
In a short space of time.
So, again, I'm struggling to see the major benefits of a winter break.
No, well, managers complain already about fixture congestion. It's only going to make that worse. All right, the Iron Man a couple of weeks off, but it's only going to make that worse. Yeah. And to be honest, a lot of the non-league teams end up effectively having a winter break because of the amount of games that are called off.
Yeah, I mean, I think the pitches are getting better across all levels, you know, so it's, I don't think you ever go on a run of a month without a game like maybe some teams used to, but people get weeks off. Teams will still get weeks off in, you know, at the top level, if they get knocked out in the FA Cup third round, they won't have a game on fourth round weekend, you know, and there are occasions where teams will get a chance to rest. And at the end of the day, I don't care what they say, they don't need 3 weeks to rest.
No.
They can have 3-4 days off, recharge the batteries, go abroad for a couple of days. They all go abroad anyway in the middle of the season.
Well, mate of mine saw Anthony Martial in the Trafford Centre yesterday. You know, so he weren't in the squad, weren't injured, given a break.
Yeah.
So
it's bonkers. Like, I saw Kevin De Bruyne. I don't know when he would have been free, but in the past couple of weeks, he's proposed to his girlfriend in Paris.
Right.
I don't know when he's had the opportunity to go to Paris, but he's had the opportunity to go to Paris. They're all given these little, you know, breaks and stuff anyway, and you know, there's no need for an extra one. That's in my opinion anyway.
Let's just call a spade a spade. They do only play 2 games of 90 minutes with a 15-minute break in between, a week.
Yeah.
That's my phone. Beer for Aaron when we next get together. that's 3, I owe you. What was I saying? They only play 2 games a week with a 15-minute break in between. Is it really that strenuous?
Yeah, but I mean, when you look
at the Tour de France.
I'm sure the amount of effort, you know, that they put into the game and the sorts of training they do will, you know, means that they are pushing their muscles, you know, to the limit. But I'm sorry, but when you are being paid as much money as you are, at the same time when you are, you know, working with the best physiotherapists, the best doctors, the best, you know, sports nutritionists and stuff like that, which is what all these football clubs have got now.
And they're paid hundreds of thousands of pounds a week to do it.
Yeah, you deal with it. You get on with it and you deal with it.
Exactly.
At the end of the day, we as fans are the people paying money to the TV companies to watch the games, to the clubs for tickets, you know, and we are the reason, you know, they're getting paid so much money. So I think they should be there to entertain us every week.
Bottom line, couldn't have summed it up any better. We'll move on from that. We are, as you know, you don't need us to tell us, but we are coming towards the end of 2016. And in fairness, it's been one of the craziest years of football I've seen in a long time. There's so much stuff happened. And what we decided to do this week was, we are going to need some lighting in there.
I'm struggling, the light's not working.
Fortunately, we do have a backup in the form of my torch.
There we go.
This is a bodge job, but we've got a torch going.
You use that, I'll get mine up. There we go.
Okay, we've got a couple of lists. And what we decided to do, because we're coming towards the end of the year, is pick a couple of categories and come up with the best of 2016. Which the four, we've picked four categories to sum up and to get you to vote on. We've gone for goals, so the best goal of 2016, the best team of 2016, the best player of 2016, and the best story of 2016. Yeah. Do you want to lead off?
Yeah.
We've each picked two categories each to go into detail about. So Aaron's first category is...
Well, I'll start with the best story of the season. I mean, and I won't delve too deep into it. We might not even be worth voting on it because I think it would be quite similar to the best team category, which okay. I know you've talked about.
Yep.
The best story of the season, I think most people will agree, is Leicester City and the way that they've risen, the way they won the title. I also think it's a great story, the fact that they have just been a complete abomination this season. I think that just adds to it even better. But they have had the success in Europe to save them. I think they've been cracking in the Champions League until they went to Portugal.
But they did field a weakened team, let's be fair.
They did, to be fair. But obviously, so you know, Leicester's story. Obviously,
yeah, the contrast of their successes has been fantastic.
Yeah. Wales, the Euros, to go from... the heartbreak of obviously the Gary Speed death in I think it was 2011
yeah.
To then turn their fortunes from kind of such a low, and to be so you know to be so passionate from there with the same squad in there, take Gary Speed's beliefs and to do what they did in the summer, you know, just a great story. Also, AFC Wimbledon, the fact that they got promoted, the fact that little AFC Wimbledon have continued their rise. And
beat the mighty Curzon on the way.
Cheers. but they got to League One. And they're not only are they in League One now, they're now pushing for promotion to the Championship, which is just absolutely bonkers for a club of their size. However, for me, personally, the best story of the season actually come this week. It's come in the last few weeks, and it has come to almost a climax this week, and it's the support which the football has shown towards the young Sunderland fan, Bradley Lowry, who obviously, for those who aren't aware, is a 5-year-old fan who's suffering from a rare type of cancer. In a few weeks' time, he won't be able to mix with other human beings. His condition is unfortunately deteriorating. But, you know, he's had the support of the world of football, and to see so many clubs come together, the likes of Newcastle donating him a Sunderland kit, which he wore when he went out on the pitch at Sunderland, the likes of Diego Costa lining him up penalty, and Asmir Begovic, you know, diving out the way of it, and then going on the scoreboard. The fact Everton have donated so much money to his, you know, his charitable efforts and stuff. I just think the whole thing, to see football coming together, for one young lad, he actually restores faith in humanity.
Absolutely.
For me personally, that's the story of 2016, and it's come right at the end. And to see that smile on his face on some of them pictures, you know, it's just really inspiring.
Absolutely agree. What a fantastic story! I know the crux of the story is terrible, but everything surrounding it just shows what football as a sport can do for somebody. Because this lad is in a terrible, terrible position, but I know and everybody else knows that something like this will make him feel on top of the world. It really, really will. And if it does something to help a similar kid in a similar position in a few years, then absolutely fantastic.
He's... as I say, the smile on his face on that picture. When he was very first mascot, I think it was for the game against Everton... earlier in the season, someone tweeted a picture of him lining up next to his favourite player, Jermaine Defoe, with a big smile on his face. And the tweet said something like, "If you're telling me that football is not just a game, then look at this." And it was bang on. Football is so much more than a game. Football was an opportunity, a relief, it's the life of this young man. And for him to be able to experience it, and for the whole country to be able to enjoy the fact that he is enjoying himself, you know, is really, really heartwarming.
Absolutely. So that is without a doubt Touchline's story of the year, and I'm sure it's a lot of other media outlets as well. It's a fantastic story, and obviously we wish Bradley all the best and a great Christmas. We'll move on from that. I'll give you my first category of the podcast, and it's going to be the best goal of 2016. Now, I've picked three goals that I think are worthy contenders. You may have different opinions. You may think, well, why has he left that goal out? Or why has he left? If you do, tweet us, comment on Facebook, whatever. We'll add it in. Or, you know what, I might have missed a goal. I'm not perfect. I might have missed a goal. But here are my three that I've picked out. We did sort of restrict ourselves to English goals, teams, British teams, British stories, British players.
Yeah.
Or players in the English league.
Stuff that's been particularly relevant to...
the UK.
To us, yeah, and our viewership.
Yeah. So the three goals I picked are just coincidentally all come from the Premier League. We'll do them in chronological order. Earlier in the year, the beginning of the year, was Jamie Vardy's unbelievable goal against Liverpool. It was, first of all, a fantastic ball by Riyad Mahrez over the top. And Vardy didn't even have a touch. First time volley. Nobody in the ground expected it. The radio commentary was particularly superb. I don't know if you actually heard that.
Yeah, yeah.
But for me, it was the context of the goal. The goal itself, if you showed it in the standalone context, was unbelievable. But it was the fact that it was against Liverpool. They won the game 2-0, and people started to actually think, "Wow, they could win the league here."
It was the exact moment. I think this is why it's so important. It is actually the same goal is on my list for a potential goal of the season as well. It was the moment where I thought, if he can do that, and Leicester can do that, they can win the title. And that's when I think, for me, truly, belief shifted. Because I think it was in February.
It was, yeah.
That was when belief for me shifted and went, my God, they can do it, or they will do it.
Yeah.
And it was on the back of that goal, and it was so significant for the rest of Leicester's season, I believe.
It really was. So that's goal number one. I'm going to give you the opportunity to vote on your favourite out of these three. Keep your eye out on Twitter over the next few days for the tweet. If you want to vote, if you don't want to vote, that's fine. But if you do, just give us a vote and tell us which one was your favourite. So that's goal number one, Jamie Vardy versus Liverpool. Goal number two was the start of this season, 2016-17. It was before Chelsea. It could have been the start of Chelsea's sort of renaissance, but it was a goal that Jordan Henderson scored against them at Stamford Bridge.
Yeah, you know, that was a... One hell of a strike.
And this one was a standalone goal because I don't think they won the game. I can't remember the result, but I don't think they won the game. But it was the fact that he just picked the ball up from all of 35 yards and it was literally right in the top corner. Couldn't have been... I don't think any goalkeeper in the world would have saved it.
Yeah, no, it was one of them. It was literally as perfectly as you could place it in between the crossbar and the post.
It was.
And considering it's come from Jordan Henderson and Manu, he's quite, let's be honest, quite often questioned about his technical ability.
Yeah.
He's not a bad footballer, but you know,
he did it again at weekend though. Did you see it against West Ham?
What a save from was it Darren Randolph?
It was, yeah.
Truly, truly outstanding save.
Yeah.
But no, it's nice though. Henderson's got that in his locker, but yeah, it's a superb strike.
Yeah, so that makes my list at number two. The third and final goal was Paul Pogba's goal about a month ago against Swansea, and that again completely. It wasn't in any context, just a standalone goal, but the technique was something. I don't think I've actually seen a goal like that before. The fact that he took the ball sort of at least waist height, sort of struck down on the ball with backspin, and it was on the rise as it went into the net. If the net weren't there, it'd still been on the rise now.
Yeah, no, they're my favourite types of goals. I love a volley, a half volley, and one where there's not, you know, like a swivel or just a straight ping where it's been hit with
frozen
some
rope.
Power. Yeah, exactly, and it just flies. For me, are my favourite goals to watch.
Without a doubt. The angle from behind that one was just superb. Yeah. It showed, that was why you pay £90 million. Yeah. I mean, he's not shown it too often this season, but for that reason, that just the technique on that goal, that was something not many not many players in the world could do.
For me, when I was watching it, I know Pogba's a big lad anyway, but every time I watch it, Pogba for me suddenly becomes about three times the size that he actually is because of the way that his leg moves the way it is. It just looks so much bigger, more powerful than any other player on the pitch, and you know he connected perfectly with it. He really, really did.
Yeah, without a doubt. So that's one, two, and three. One goal that nearly made my list, just missed the cut. And I'll give this as an alternate. Was Alexis Sanchez against Ludo Gretz, and the reason this didn't make it was because it was something I'd describe as a cheeky goal. I don't know if you remember it. I think it was the first goal of the game.
The chip,
yeah.
Yeah.
It was absolutely sumptuous, and only somebody like Sanchez could actually pull this off, but it came to an edge of the box. All right, maybe he had a bit more freedom because they were playing Ludo Gretz and It might have been a couple of goals up at the time, but the finish was just superb. Absolute class. So if I'll make it a four. We'll make it a four.
Yeah.
So that's 1, 2, 3, and 4. Put Sanchez there as an alternate. If you've not seen these goals, I'll try my best to tweet the YouTube links, but have a look on YouTube yourself, and please just vote for your favourite. Just for fun. Doesn't do anything for us. We ain't going to lose sleep or whatever you vote for, but they're the best four goals for me. I don't know if you've got any others to add in.
Well, I was say, I know that your Twitter poll can only have four in it, so they're your four, but I say that I listed four goals myself, wondering whether you were going to say them, and the Vardy goal is the only one you actually said.
Okay, right.
One of the ones I'd have referred to was right the way back in January. Dele Alli at Crystal Palace.
You know what? I looked at that one.
For me, just great quality, great ability. My other two actually come from the European Championships in the summer.
Okay.
Hal Robson-Kanu.
The Cruyff.
The Cruyff turn and finish. That was. I was in awe of that goal. Super. I just thought for someone like him, someone whose career has been on an absolute downward spiral.
Yeah.
So a man without a club at the time.
Yeah. Free agent.
And he pulls that out on the biggest stage against Belgium. Just phenomenal.
Yeah.
And also Shaqiri's overhead kick.
Yeah. The only reason I didn't include that one was because it was Switzerland against bail me out. Poland, was it? Did you write it down?
Just hold on 1 second. Poland, yes it was.
There you go, good knowledge. He could have qualified because he plays in the Premier League, but
I tell you what, you also reminded me of another goal when you mentioned Sanchez and Ludogorets. When they went to the away leg, Mesut Ozil's chip, stutter, weight, stutter, whatever he did.
Yeah.
I mean, probably not the goal of 2016, but you reminded me of that goal, and that was just brilliant.
Superb.
Individual quality.
Yeah, it showed his class. Another player that can go a game and you don't realise on the field, but then he'll come up with something like that.
Yeah, no, he's... I saw an interesting debate on Twitter, and we'll save this for another... another discussion, but who could Arsenal deal with losing most? Would they cope better if they lost Sanchez, or cope better if they lost Ozil? And one of the arguments I saw, I mean, a lot of people obviously went for Sanchez because he is brilliant, but a few Arsenal fans that I know said, well, there is nobody else in the world like Ozil when he's on form.
Okay.
Which is an interesting argument. It's an interesting debate for another time. Anyway.
Okay, well, yeah, like you say, we'll come back to that. I think the episode will be the 29th, if today's the 15th. 29th, the one before New Year, we'll come back to that, because that's interesting.
Yeah.
Give us your player, or your three players, or however many you've nominated, as player of the year.
Yeah, three players. I mean, they all come from the Premier League, or they are now in the Premier League.
Okay.
Obviously, Jamie Vardy has to go in as the first nominee. The fact that, I mean, I know it kind of carried over from 2015, but he finished the season, you know, in just sublime form, scored vital goals for Leicester. The whole story of everything, going to the Euros as well, scoring the goal against Wales, which, you know, proved to be, you know, so crucial in that one. Then maybe having a dipper form at the end of the year, but proving he still got it with that hat-trick last week against Manchester City.
Yep.
You know, a great, great player. It's just a great story to see someone come from the lower reaches or the lower echelons of the football pyramid and do that.
Absolutely. Because I remember watching Jamie Vardy play against Stalybridge Celtic for Stocksbridge in, I think, 2009. And I think Celtic pumped them 6-0 that day, or 5-0.
Yeah.
Funny old game, isn't it?
I remember, I wrote a couple of years ago of the story, Jamie Vardy scoring a 4-minute hat-trick against my dad's Mosley team. All of them identical goals, all of them just, I mean, we had two giants of centre-halves who kept him quiet all day, you know, because he's not the biggest lad, it was a physical game. But as soon as our two big lads, you know, got you know, a little
would
bit
it been Andy Watson?
No, it wasn't. It was Graham Kay and Liam
Coyne.
Graham
Kay played for Curzon, didn't he?
He did, yeah.
Yeah.
Goose, he was.
Yeah, yeah. I remember him now.
And Liam Coyne was the other one, who was 6'7". He was a giant. He was a beast. He was a cracking player. But neither of them had much pace. And it's quite well documented in the Premier League now just how quick Jamie Vardy is.
Yeah.
So with the game at 1-1, with 10 minutes left, Stocksbridge realise our centre-backs are getting tired. Start pumping long balls forward. and three times in 4 minutes, they got over the back of the centre-backs. He ran through, one-on-one, finish.
Yeah, one thing he can do is finish.
Three identical goals.
Yeah.
And a quick-fire hat-trick. And I wouldn't say that day, that was the day I thought he was going to go on to the Premier League, because I'll sound like a... You know, predicted it. You know, you knew he was too good for that level. You never thought he was going to go on to achieve what he did, and full credit to him.
So, Jamie Vardy's option one?
It is. Option number two is actually going to go for Marcus Rashford. Because at the start of 2016, I didn't have a bloody clue who he was.
Same here. And I'm a United fan.
His rise to has been, like Vardy, incredible. It's just been, he came in, couldn't stop scoring. I'm a City fan. I was willing him to keep on scoring because I just thought, this is incredible. Just this kid coming in, playing with freedom, playing like he hasn't got a care in the world.
And you knew that he could be option two on your best of 2016 players.
Yeah, I knew he was going to get there. What a year for him. I know he's slowed down a little bit now. Things are a little bit tougher.
Is he a winger or a striker?
He's a striker.
Yeah, I agree.
He's a striker. He's somebody you can finish, but he takes people on as well. And I know people say, oh, well, if you can take people on, you should be out on the wing doing that. Well, no, you shouldn't. You've got to be able to take on, you know, people down the middle, you know, your defensive midfielders, your centre-backs. You've got to be able to get around them, run past them, make runs.
Yeah.
That's what he does well. The great thing is he gets the ball at his feet and it looks like he's under no instruction. He's just like, right, I'm going to drive forward and see what happens.
Yeah.
And for me, the most exciting player to watch.
Yeah, and the good thing about him is he's nowhere near the finished package. He's, what, 19?
Yeah, no. He's still got a lot to add to his game. I still think technically he's maybe lacking slightly when it comes to, you know, like keeping hold of possession at certain points. But he's a great talent, and Manchester United should be very thankful that they've got him.
Absolutely. So if Rashford is your player of the year, click vote.
It actually brings me on, interestingly, to a completely different style of play for my third player of the year. Also, bizarrely with me, is another Manchester United player.
Okay.
In Zlatan Ibrahimovic.
Right.
It was 2016. And I'd say that simply because of, if you consider the whole year, what he did at the back end of last season with Paris Saint-Germain, he continued his imperious record. He broke, you know, obviously broke his own records, kept on scoring, and then made a real, real bold move, you know, by saying, I'm going to go to the Premier League, a place where most people thought he was going to struggle. Myself being one of them. I say that on the basis of Champions League last year. He struggled against the Lyakhin with Mangala in the leg at the Etihad. And I genuinely thought maybe this physical nature of the league, you know, won't suit him. But he's come over, he's adapted, he's continued on his fine form, and he's had a great scoring record. I just think the way he's conducted himself, how entertaining he is, the fact that he can still be so much of an athlete at his age, I think he's fantastic, and for me, he definitely deserves a nomination.
Definitely. Somebody said, I think it was on Twitter, somebody said they couldn't think of a player doing what he's doing at the age of 35 in the most competitive league in the world. I can't.
No.
Or I have done over the years, I can't think of anybody.
I mean, what? How old was Didier Drogba when he left?
33, 34. So he's on sort of a par.
Because, I mean, Drogba, even when Drogba was come to the end of his career, obviously, I know he's still playing.
I think he could have been 36 when he... Because he came back. Did he come back to Chelsea? Yeah.
But he came back and he kept on scoring, to be fair. And I think that's what made Drogba one of the greats. He was very much a late bloomer, Drogba.
Yeah.
Like, whereas Zlatan's now done it for years and years. Drogba only really started scoring at maybe the age of 26, 27.
Right.
But, I mean, other than that, you can't really think... I mean, Zlatan, 35 years old, and he's making runs and cheeky finishes like he did last night at Crystal Palace.
In the 88th minute.
Yeah, just great. And the great thing is about him, he looks like he's still enjoying it. He doesn't look like he's trying to pick up a wage packet.
No.
It looks like he has a laugh on the training ground. He's quite serious on the pitch. And he's been surprisingly impressive.
Do you know what? I think I said at the start of the season, I said I'd be surprised if he scored 10 goals this season. That was just my opinion. Yeah. And he's gladly prove me wrong.
Yeah, well, he's already on his way to scoring more goals. What was it this week? They were saying how he's going to score more goals this season than Michael Owen did in three.
That's what Mourinho said.
That was Mourinho. A little dig at Michael Owen, which Owen, you know, tried to bite back at and couldn't.
No. Really. Well, I saw a video today about the best of Michael Owen's quotes over the years, and there's some absolute belters in there.
I watched it. If they score more goals, they're going to win.
Yeah, that would have been a great penalty if it had gone in. Great penalty, except it went wide or something like that. Yeah. He'd have scored if he were offside.
Yeah, he's...
Pundit of the year. He's our pundit of the year.
Yeah, yeah, he can have it. He's just for the entertainment that he's given us.
All right, quick fire, eh?
Yep.
No vote. Pick your two favourite commentators.
Commentator or pundit?
Both. Lead commentator, ooh, co-commentator. All right, lead commentary pairing and a pundit.
Lead commentator, I mean, Ian Dark on BT Sport, I think he's very good at the moment.
Yeah.
I think BT have got a real good on him. As a co-commentator, I'm not too sure. It's a tough one. It's hard to assess BT's commentators because they have so many co-commentators on one with them that it's... So I think Howard Webb actually being on the panel for things like that actually has been a real asset to the Premier League and for coverage because they've never had anything like that before.
Yeah, good idea.
As far as pundits concerned, anyway, I mean, I'll get slated this. I think Glenn Hoddle speaks a hell of a lot of sense.
Right, okay.
If you'd listened, I mean, I think he comes across a bit annoying, maybe a bit like he's still a bit in the past, but I think what he says is actually really, really insightful.
Yeah, don't mind Hoddle.
Pundit wise, I never used to like him as a manager. Harry Redknapp, every time he gets a little gig. He's been doing a bit of radio recently with Jim White on Talk Sport.
Yeah.
So interesting, because he tells you all the nuts and crannies, you know, about the details and stuff. And I actually feel like I learn something when I listen to him, which is what from a pundit, and when I'm listening to an expert talk about the game, that's what I want to see, that's what I want to hear.
You want somebody to break the game down and put it simply to the people that are not sure.
Yeah, and he gives... And the thing I like about Harry Redknapp as well is he looks like he manages people on the personalities, not just on the footballing ability.
Yeah.
And that comes across in his punditry. So you get to see a slightly different side of the game.
Yeah, I agree with Dark. I quite like Glenn Hoddle. I quite like Steve McManaman as a co-commentator. I actually think he's all right. He calls it as it is.
Yeah.
He did really well in the Everton game the other night.
Admittedly... I wouldn't have ever put him in like my top, you know, co-commentators. But at the same time, I have no reason for him to be anywhere near the bottom. Like, I can't think of one smear I've got against his name, or one time I've thought, what are you on about? So,
I'll tell you what's interesting there.
Suppose you want to go unnoticed as a co-commentator in a weird way.
Yeah. You don't want. Yeah, it's like a referee.
Yeah.
What's weird though? We neither of us have picked anybody from Sky.
Well, I mean, obviously, I think...
Gary Neville's the obvious one.
Yeah, Neville's an obvious choice, what a lot of people will say. Carragher's definitely getting better. Thierry Henry's getting better. But...
I've had enough of Martin Tyler. Have you? I've had enough of him now.
Yeah, he's had his moments in the sun. You hear him all the time. I just think, for me with Sky, I do think they are lagging behind BT.
Yeah.
Now on the coverage.
Yeah.
I know a lot of people will disagree, but I just think for the level of pundits that they get on, the production of the programmes, BT are actually blowing Sky out of the water at the moment. Last 2 years, they've smashed it.
I agree. The best thing about Sky's coverage is the hour before or the hour after Monday Night Football.
Yeah. No. Absolutely. And I think it doesn't help the fact that, for me, like things like Sky Sports News and the almost cheesiness of it now. It shouldn't be cheesy, but it's cheesy.
It is. It's become a cliche.
And it just makes it so cringy to watch.
Yeah.
And that kind of passes through into, you know, some of the live coverage as well.
Absolutely.
which is not ideal.
Yeah. Okay, so the last category, we're not voting on pundits, that was just a bit of fun. The last category to vote on is the team of the year. And it's probably the biggest foregone conclusion since Wimbledon came back and beat Curzon. No, I'm joking. I'm joking.
Enough for that now.
I struggle to pick two teams, really, because there's literally only one that can win this. You'll probably prove me all wrong and vote for team two, but team one is Leicester, as we've touched on, the most unbelievable sporting story that I can remember. I'm absolutely... At the time, I said, let's actually just take a moment and actually consider what we're a part of and what we're watching here. Leicester's title win was something that we'll never see it again, to quote the great Martin Tyler. A team like Leicester, virtually relegated the year before, won the league, looking like relegated again, suddenly through in the Champions League. It is a sensational story.
For me, I think it'll sink in about 3 years' time when they inevitably get relegated back to the Championship.
Yeah, sell all the players.
Yeah, and you see little old Leicester struggling in the second tier again, because it does feel like it's probably going to happen again in a few years.
Yeah,
and when you see them struggling there, and you go, look at what they did.
Yeah,
I think that's when it'll hit you fully. You know, the size of the achievements, because let's be honest, they were incredible. They were. I don't know how they did it. I like the bit about Claudio Ranieri, the fact that he got sacked by Greece because they lost to the Faroe Islands. I mean, Greece, a nation who should be qualifying for, you know, the European Championships and the World Cups, and, you know, should have the name in the hat, and yet they're struggling against the Faroe Islands, and yet the manager behind that failure was the manager a year later behind that unprecedented success. You know, just incredible. No idea how he's done it.
Nope. Don't think any of us will figure it out. And the second team I've written down is Leicester. No, I'm joking. It's a foregone conclusion. But the second team I've put down is Wales, because let's take Leicester out of it. Wales would have been the team of the season every other season, because it's been a sort of a journey for Wales, like Aaron touched on earlier, since Gary Speed passed away in 2011. The 5 years since then, just been absolutely unthinkable for Wales. Risen to 8th in the world, I think their peak ranking was, and now 11th. Or 12th, but their journey at the Euros, get to the semi-finals, it was nothing short of superb. And like I say, any other year, they'd be definitely contenders for team of the season, and they still are. But I'm not trying to push you in any direction here. But if you don't vote for Leicester, I think you're watching the wrong game. But
yeah, absolutely.
One player I thought you might have gone for in your player of the season was N'Golo Kanté.
I considered it. I considered him, and I also considered Riyad Mahrez.
Yeah.
I just kind of felt they were all kind of in the same boat. To be fair, I think Kante was probably more likely to get in than Mahrez, as good as Mahrez has been.
Because of what he's done at Chelsea as well.
Yeah, the way he, you know, has adapted himself, and he's, whatever team he's played in, has been solid.
Yeah.
And he's just. Oh, it's just a word. The man runs and runs and runs. I have no idea where they found him, because they bought him from like a second tier team in France, didn't they? Or something like that.
Same with Mahrez.
Just whoever the scouts are, then, you know, they need, you know, big pay rise. You know, they're the true heroes too.
And it shows that you don't need huge investments to win a league title. You just need clever. Yeah, money management.
Yeah, you've got to invest in the right places, and if that means investing in a better scouting team, then, you know, you'll actually probably, you know, see reap the benefits on a long term.
Absolutely. So there are four categories: goals, teams, players, and story of 2016. We will leave a recap of the contenders on Twitter, so keep your eye out for that. Place your vote. Whatever you vote for is absolutely fine. We have no favourites. Just a bit of fun. If you don't want to vote, fine. But click vote. It only takes 2 seconds. Apart from that, I think that is virtually about it. It's going to be the last episode before Christmas, so I'd like to wish all the listeners a very Merry Christmas. Thank you for listening to this programme, because it does mean a great deal to us. I know a few of you do listen religiously every week, which we do greatly appreciate. If you can just take the time to leave us a 5-star rating on iTunes, like a friend of Aaron's did last week, it goes a long, long way to helping us, because the further we get pushed up the iTunes charts via the ratings, the more chance people will find us on the off chance, rather than relying on our advertising and word of mouth. So it takes a minute to do. Leave us a 5-star review, and we will be eternally grateful. Aaron, thank you very, very much for joining us once again on episode 7.
No, my pleasure. I still don't know why you keep inviting me back, but I'm happy to be here.
I think the listeners probably think you're more knowledgeable than me, so I'm the glue that holds it together, but you're the meat on the steak.
Oh, stop it, you flirt.
No, always greatly appreciated. Have a good Christmas.
Cheers, mate.
Curzon celebrate Celtic Boxing Day. I presume you'll be there.
Yeah, I've got to work Boxing Day morning, but I'm gonna be getting out early to rush over to Bower Fold for Derby Day.
Yeah,
and hopefully watch Curzon smash Bridge.
Like they did on Monday in the Premier Cup. Was it Tuesday?
Yeah, we weakened our team.
Oh, did you really?
Bridge didn't. So just putting it out there.
Yeah, so I look forward to seeing you on Boxing Day. Thanks again for joining us. Thank you to you for listening at home. Have a great festive period. Happy holidays, as the Americans say. And tune in between Christmas and New Year for our recap of 2016. Thank you very much.